Now we're cooking with oil. So the internet is a great resource. You know, whenever we want to find out how to do something, we go and we Google it. I think that's the proper name for that now. But there's little in terms of why, when, what. The how is fine, but this talk is not about the how. So what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about what is a cache. I'm going to go over core concepts, some more advanced concepts, and we'll talk about caching on premises and in Windows Azure. Throughout the deck, you'll see guidance and concept slides marked with green and blue. Okay. And the presentation, the deck itself is going to be available, if it's not already available, for download. So you don't need to frantically take pictures or write notes. Non-goals for today. Sorry. Goals. How about that? The goal for today is to really, really understand caching. Really, fundamentally, what that thing is. And my goal in the next 70 minutes is for you to become cache gurus. Right. Non-goals is to show you demos. I'm not going to show you any demos. If you're looking for demos, you're in the wrong place. Reason? Demos won't make you gurus in 70 minutes. And the reason why that is because most demos are like, let me go and configure the cache to do something. Let me show you that it did what I just told it to do, which is basically product testing on stage. So we're not going to do that. If you do want to see those things, links to download, samples, videos of how those things were done, all this information is available online. What I'm going to give you today is stuff that is not available online. And that's the focus of this talk. How many people here were at this morning's session? I know a few about caching. All right. So for the rest of you who hadn't, and for people who must see a demo, we're going to do something different. We're going to do a mental demo. Here's the Equicentral cache demo. I'm going to put up a fabricated website, and then I'm going to fabricate a call to a fabricated database that doesn't look at all like what you have on premises. And then I'm going to time how long it's going to take to make that call. I'm going to show it in big red letters on the screen. It's going to be, you know, 200 milliseconds. Then I'm going to go into the code and add caching, and I'm going to run a query again against the database. And it's going to go look in the cache, not in the cache, it's going to go in the database. It's going to come back. It's going to be 200 milliseconds. Then I'm going to hit refresh, and then your mind is going to be blown because it's going to be so fast fetching it from the cache. And applause, roaring applause, paparazzi, flowers on stage. It's going to be amazing. Okay? It's not going to happen because it's silly. All right? So cache demos are silly. Caching itself, not silly. We're going to talk about caching and really understand that, and that's the goal for today. And with that, we'll start with a quiz. What is caching? Is it A, mechanism for storing data close to where it's used? B, a mechanism used to speed up a system? C, a mechanism for decreasing load on system components like a database or a web service? Or D, all of the above? And if you answer D, you are correct. And it's either that you're already on your way to becoming cache gurus or that you know a thing or two about how computer systems work, because caching is nothing new, right? We have caching on the CPU. We have caching in the drives. We have caching in the operating system. There's caching all over the place. Right? This enables you to bring caching into your application. And what's the number one rule of caching? The number one most important rule of caching is that if you're using caching, then you need to be okay with working with possibly stale data. Possibly stale data, which means that it's data that is not as fresh as the data that is in the system of record, whatever that is, a database or something else. Why? Because I fetched it a little while ago. So cached data should be considered, quote unquote, historical, captured at some point in the past, and may not represent what is right now in the system of record. Now, there are ways to overcome this. We're going to talk about patterns in this talk about how you make that work. But generally speaking, that's the number one rule. So let's talk about caching in a web application, right? So I have this web app, you know, client tier, data tier, and got a bunch of requests. Things are going happily. My website's becoming successful, right? So I'm starting to see some long load and delays and times, and I'm starting to see some load on the database as well. What do? Introduce a cache. So I put a cache in there. Now I get speed up for application. Database load is reduced because I'm not running every query to the database, and everything is good. My site becomes even more popular, even more successful. Now I have more users. What do? Well, I'll add another server and a little load balancer, and life is happy, right? And here's an interesting scenario. So first request comes in, goes to the load balancer to the one on the left, right? And some version of the data goes in, gets cached, and sent to the client. Right? The next user comes in, but before that happens, there's an update to the database. So now, that next user that came in will get version 2 of the data, and version 2 is cached. Now we have a problem, because the different users will see different data depending on how the load balancer sends them. How do we solve that? We take the cache outside of the web service, or the web server, and we use it in a shared way. So now we have one cache that's being used across all of my servers. Okay? And that's the concept of a distributed cache that is taken outside of the application, not part of your server, but put somewhere else. At least conceptually, put somewhere else. So Windows Server App Fabric caching, I'm going to start by talking about Windows Server App Fabric caching, but almost everything that I say apply in the cloud as well, and we'll talk at the end about the differences. Okay? So it's free, distributed, and memory cache. And it allows you to take memory from a lot of different servers and create one large, big cache that is distributed amongst all those nodes. And that's a place to put all this temporary data. And the way you put the data in is you use key value pairs. Key is a key to get the data, and then the value is the data itself. And the value can be any data that you can serialize in and out. And if you're using the cache from .NET, then it's any serializable .NET object can be put in and taken out of the cache given its key. And that distributed cache gives us a broader scope than on-machine caching because it gives us more memory, it supports more concurrent users, it gives us more possibilities. The reason why it supports more concurrent users is because I don't have to have a cache of the data on each one of the instances of the servers like I had before in the case where every server held its own cache. Right now I have one copy across my entire cache server. And that'll give me better overall performance and absolutely better system utilization because, again, I'm not keeping duplicates of the data in the multiple little caches. So let's start talking about concepts. The first concept is the concept of a unified view. And if you're coming from Memcache or other some cache technologies, that could be a confusing point. So unified view, here's what it is. I got all my caches or cache servers, and each one of those servers holds a segment, a portion of the cache. From a client's perspective, I don't want to deal with that. From a client's perspective, I want the client's view to be unified across all those servers. So I don't need to know or think about where is my data. So the nodes are coordinated, and they create this unified view. And the API abstracts the cluster so that I don't need to think about where should I store this data or where is this data that I or somebody else stored. All I need to do is use the key, and then there's a hashing function that finds out which one of the servers actually has the data. Thank you. Next concept, data categorization. If you only take one thing from this talk, one thing at all, this is what I want you to take. This is what I want you to take away. And this is true for all sorts of data, not just data that you put in the cache, but it is extremely important in the context of the cache, and we're going to keep talking about it throughout the presentation. Reference data, resource data, activity data. Reference data, it's like a reference book, right? Everybody has the same reference books. We all get the same books. We all read the data. This is about read heavier, it's because they're read only, right? Data that hardly ever changes, and it is shared between users. So things like product descriptions, profile data, etc. Things that don't change very often or at all are called reference data. The next category of data is resource data. Resource data is data that is a shared resource, as the name implies. We all use it. We all read, we all write. It's a shared thing, right? Number of units in stock, right? As I update the number of units in stock, I need to go and I remove the unit from stock. I'm going to go and update the cache, right? And so everybody else is going to read from the cache is going to read that. That's a resource data, and it has this read-write nature to it. And the last one is activity. And activity is really about something that is user-specific, okay? Like my session information in a web browser session. Web browsing session is something that's specific for me right now. That's an activity that I'm doing. Okay, so it's user-specific, it's read-write, but because it's user-specific, it is very different than the read-write of a resource data, and we'll explain why. All right, so Cache Guru pop quiz. What is the one? Now you can shout it out after I ask the question, or you can think about it in your head, but I'm really trying to make sure that this stays in here. So what's this thing that is shared and read heavy?
Reference data.
Reference data. Correct. Shared read write.
Resource.
And then user specific? That's an activity. Excellent. Excellent. All right. First guidance, determine what data you're going to cache. Categorize the data, cache it appropriately. It's going to affect everything, where you store it, how long you store it for, if you want explicit deletion or not. There's a whole bunch of things that are going to be affected by the data categorization, as we will see in the next 60 slides that I have on that. And the other point is to cache the right data. And this goes back to what this gentleman and I were talking about after the first presentation. So caching output is not always the right thing to do. You need to figure out what is it that I'm going to cache so that it's most reusable. Because the thing about cache is that you want to adhere to a more or less 9-to-1, so 90-10. That's the ratio. So you want to, if you write something, you're going to want to read it at least 10 times. Or 9 times. That's kind of a ballpark number. So you want something that is reusable, and how do you do that? Let me give you an example, concrete example from a client. So the client had a profile service. It was one of their services that they had in their SOA implementation. And the way that worked is that they had multiple companies, right? They had clients, but then with each company, every user in that company had a specific setting, customization on top of what was allowed for that company. So when I want to go to the service and say, you know, give me the settings for this user, I need to go and combine the ones for the company and the ones for the user, and then conjure up what I'm going to serve. So we call get setting for user one of company one. Right? We'll go to the company setting, we'll fetch the company one setting, and then we'll go to the user customization, we'll fetch that, we'll combine that, okay, and then we'll cache the customer. Sorry, the company, as well as the that combination. So if that user comes back again, I can just serve it right now. But I also cache the company information separately. Okay. So now, send that to the user. Everything is good. Next up, please give me user two of company one. I already have the data for company one in the cache. So all I need to do is bring the user information for company two. So I'm only doing one database query instead of two. Fetch out one from the cache, put that together, and save that. Okay? Next piece of guidance. And this is, again, something that is critical, critical, probably should have put this as the first piece of guidance, is to assume best effort caching. Because your application must be okay without data, must work okay without the data being in the cache. And that data could not be in the cache because of all sorts of problems. It could be that the cache is unavailable. It could be that the data that you put in the cache is unavailable. And it is absolutely possible that you would put something in the cache and say, I want this thing to be cached for 5 days. And you go a second later and it's not there. And that absolutely normal behavior for a cache, as we will see why. Because the cache doesn't guarantee data retention. And then, the last thing here is don't store important information only in the cache. You can obviously store it in the cache, but not only in the cache. If it's costly to reproduce, if it's crucial for the proper operating of your application, don't just put it in the cache. I've seen that happen. Not good. Next up. Turns out that caches behave very interestingly. This particular one, if you want to dive into the detail, come find me afterwards and we'll talk about all the wonderful things that .NET does with large memory heap and small memory heap, and there's a whole bunch of stuff and generations of garbage collection. Point is this. There is this performance variation that depends on the number of objects that you have in the cache and the size of each object. If you put large objects, the cache behaves not as good as if you put small ones. So you want to cache the smallest one possible. But then again, if I need to go and fetch multiple little pieces from the cache, that is also affecting performance. So there's a sweet spot somewhere in the middle. It's closer to the small one, I can already tell you that. But there's a sweet spot somewhere. And you need to measure the performance of your cache and optimize for that sweet spot. Now, what you don't want to do is you don't want to take one and say, I got this big thing that I need to store in the cache, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to chop it up to little pieces and then put all the little pieces in the cache, and then when I want it, I'll go and I'll reassemble all the little pieces from the cache. But remember what I just said about the fact that if you put something in the cache, there's no guarantee you'll be able to get it back. And so if you broke something down to 10 little pieces, and now one of them is missing, then all the other ones are just there occupying space because you can't reconstruct it. Okay? And I've seen people do that. I had a client that was storing, for just lack of understanding, both the session ID and the user ID in the cache as the key. It's unique, right? Turns out that the session ID is unique enough, right? And so what you want, the thing is that the key also takes memory. It also occupies memory in the cache. And they weren't storing large things for the free session. They weren't storing large things. And so what I'm telling you is use the minimum amount of unique data that you can then get back again as the key so that you don't just overload the cache. And we managed to cut about 15 to 20% of the cache usage by just making the keys smaller for that particular area of the cache, which we'll talk about later. All right. So the next concept is write-aside cache. Okay, a write-aside cache is this mechanism for stashing the data. It's the cache, right? Putting some data nearby so I can get hold of it fairly easily. But it is kind of a scratch pad, right? It's something that's on the side. And then the client, if it's a service or a website or whatever, is responsible for managing what is in that cache explicitly. There's a call to say, put in this cache, get from the cache, update this data in the cache, delete the data from the cache. Right? And when you delete data from the cache, you can do this explicitly, but you could also do this implicitly by saying, here's how long objects that are put in the cache should live. You can specify this for the entire cache cluster as a default expiration policy. Right? You could do this for each time you put something in the cache. You can say for this, not each time, you can do this whenever you put something in the cache, you can say, these ones are, just use the default, but for this call, use this expiration policy. Okay? You can, if something is about to expire, you can go and refresh that expiration, so extend that expiration. And when things expire, eventually the cluster will automatically clean them up and remove them. So you need to use write-aside cache appropriately. So use it primarily for reference data. That's a really good fit. If you use it for reference data, there's practically no data access contention. Right? There's a more efficient solution. We're going to talk about what that is. But you can use it for reference data. You can also use it for resource data. If you use it for resource data, so again, reference, remember shared, read, heavy, resource, shared, read, write. If you do that, then you need to use the appropriate concurrency control mechanisms, and we're going to talk about concurrency. And you can also use it for activity data. For activity data, it's a perfect fit. For activity data, we got no contentions. We got, you know, it's very efficient. That's kind of the best use for that. Okay? But again, you can use it across all three. Next concept, regions. So in a programming language, in order to avoid name collisions, we use namespaces, right? That's kind of the, in programming, that's what we do in all modern programming languages. In the cache, we also have keys, and so in order to avoid name collisions on the keys, we use this mechanism called regions. Okay? And a region is a named area within the cache, and there's always a named region that you're working with. If you specify nothing, there's one called default, that's its name, right? D-E-F-A-L-U-T, default. That if you don't specify anything, it gets added for you. Okay, but you can programmatically go and create and delete more regions. So this is useful when you have multiple apps that share a cache cluster so they don't collide, but also if you have different areas within a single app so that they don't collide either. Okay, again, that namespace notion, that's what that cache region is about. Tags. So if you read blogs, you'll notice that like entries in blog posts, they often get little like metadata associated with them, tags, right? So you can look at all the blogs on a particular topic, if somebody blogs on multiple topics, right? It's sort of this metadata that helps you find things. And so it's the exact same context here, content, exact same thing here, how about that? Which is a thing that it describes what is that data in the cache. And then I don't have to put one, but I can put as many as I want. And then I can use that later on. I specify it when it's created, and it's immutable. I can't go and change that. I cannot change the tags on something that I already put in the cache. If I want to do that, I need to basically delete it and put another one in with the updated tags. Okay? And then I can use those tags to look and find things in the cache. So for example, if I want to go and delete everything that had to do with a particular something that I tagged, then I can say, give me all the keys for this tag, and then I can say, okay, now delete them all. Okay? So, basic concepts, talked about the unified view. Right, API abstracts all the servers. We talked about data categorization, reference activity and resource data. Talked about the write-aside cache, tags, and regions. Let's talk about what happens to this data after it's time for it to go. There are three ways in which data gets removed from the cache. One is explicit deletion. That's obvious, right? I go and I explicitly make a call to remove data from the cache. And then there's expiration and eviction. Expiration is like old milk. Okay? You want that thing to be removed from your fridge, preferably by somebody else. Right? And so that's the idea here with expiration. Okay? Proactively remove from the cache because it is stale. Right? It's time to live, it expired. Eviction is something that is usually not good. Right? You don't want to be evicted. You don't want your data to be evicted. You don't want data to be evicted unless it's that annoying neighbor who pollutes the cache and never deletes his stuff. In that case, yeah, I want that thing evicted. But eviction is usually a case of moving something reactively, not proactively, reactively because of low memory conditions. Okay. So let me talk about how we specify this, and then I'll show you more visually how this thing works. So remember, expiration is a hint to the system on how long to keep something. Now, if you say this thing should expire at that point in time, and you go and ask for it after that point in time, the system will not give it back to you because it says you don't want that thing anymore. It might still keep it, right, and delete it later, but it's still, so it could still be in memory. And you can specify the expression again, as I said, for the entire cluster or in each add or put operation, add or update. And that time is relative to when it was created. So you say, I want this thing to be in the cache for 5 minutes. Okay? There's a little trick that I'm going to show in a little bit about how you can say, I want this to expire at midnight. I don't care when that is. And your midnight could be different than your midnight because you're East Coast and you're West Coast. Okay? And then if you got something, it's about to expire. It's a classic example for this is a session, right? The browsing session. So you want the browsing session to expire after 10 minutes of inactivity. It's not 10 minutes, it's 10 minutes of inactivity. So every time the user interacts with his session, I want to extend that session 10 more minutes. Right? And that's that last bit here. So let's visualize this. The cache has got two configurable settings. You typically use PowerShell to go in and configure those things. And they're called the high watermark and the low watermark. Default settings are 70% and 90% of the available memory for the cache. As long as you're below that, life is good. When you get above the low watermark, then the expired objects are starting to be evicted, right? Because cleaning the memory is something that takes time. As long as I don't need to go and clean the memory, I'm going to hold off on that. That's the whole point about garbage collection. Right? So think about the same idea as garbage collection. Okay? But if I'm filling the cache more rapidly, then the deletion rate of expired objects, or if the objects don't expire and I still put stuff in the cache, and I go beyond the high water mark, then non-expired objects are going to be evicted. That explains why things that I just put in the cache, and I said I need this to be there for the next 15 minutes, can disappear like that. So make sure that if you don't want things to disappear, if you don't want to use the sessions to disappear, don't hit that bar. Make sure you have enough memory, or remember the point about if something is very important, don't only keep it in the cache? That's this point. Now, you can turn eviction off. There's a switch that says don't evict. And when you do that, you're risking what? What? Maxing out the cache, right? You're evicting out of memory. You're risking out of memory. Right? So you need to make sure that you don't run out of memory. Or if you do run out of memory, then you do something about that. So here's this little trick about local time-based expiration. So the situation is this. I have, say, a pricing list that I want to expire at midnight. Right, because that's what it is. The price expires at midnight, but midnight changes, right? Midnight on the East Coast is not the same as midnight on the West Coast. So the way to do that is by creating a function that maps now, whatever now is for the user, because you can know the user's time zone and time from the client. The browser sends the time zone usually. So you can map to whatever that region that you want to expire on is. And then add that to the original key. So in my case, the example that I gave, so you take the SKU, the product ID, right, and you add to that the time, say today, today's date. Right? So what happens when the user moves on to the next day? Right? Then now will be different than that time segment, and you won't longer find it in the cache for that user, but it'll be there for other users in different time zones. Okay? Little trick. So I talked about this. I said that there's something better for reference data. That's the local cache. So the local cache is basically another layer of caching, okay, that is very useful for reference data. Might not work so well for other kinds, but it's very useful for reference data. Okay? And it's the cache that lives on the client side. So you got the big cache, but there's a little cache on the client side. And when that's enabled, then when data is being fetched from the cache, it needs to be fetched from the cache, deserialized, but then the cache, the local cache, keeps a reference to that deserialized object. So not only are you saving the time to talk to the server back and forth, you're also saving deserialization time, and basically you end up with a hash table lookup, which takes nanoseconds. Now obviously, local cache is a lot smaller than the shared cache. And so because it's more restricted, there you need to basically be aware of how much data you put in there. Okay? The default is to put 10,000 objects. It doesn't count by size, it counts by number of objects. Why? Because it's easier. Okay? And then you got three things to control when things go out of that local cache, because remember, it's small. First of all is max objects. Okay? So when you hit the default or whatever it is that you configured for the maximum number of objects, that thing goes and removes about 20% of the the ones that were not used. How about that? The least frequently used ones. Then you have local lifetime restrictions where you can say, I want things to live in the local cache for 1 minute. That's another way. And then there's a third thing, which is pool-based notifications. So the client on an interval would go and say, here are all the IDs that I have cached locally. Did any of them expire on your end or was updated on your end? And then the server would say, yeah, these were updated, and then the client will remove that. Okay? And that thing has performance implications, as you can imagine. But still, it's done, because we're talking about reference data, then that thing wouldn't happen very. You don't need to do that very often. You can do that every 5 minutes. Right? And that, in most cases, would be good enough. So use the local cache with great care. Okay? First, it increases memory pressure on the client side. And when memory pressure increases, the system starts doing swapping back and forth between the memory and drive, that actually might make your application run slower. So you say, ooh, local cache, that's blazing fast. Yeah, the cache itself is fast, but it has implications that are broader than just the cache. Pool notification cost, and very interestingly, the local cache doesn't make copies of the data. So it deserialized, it keeps that thing, and when somebody asks for this piece of data, they get this. Everybody who's asking for it gets this exact same object. So if you try to write, or if any of them updates the object, and somebody else comes and fetches it, it gets the updated object. Right? Careful. Of course, it increases the staleness, and therefore you want to use it for basically quote-unquote immutable objects, things that change very frequently on the server. Mentioned concurrency. Let's talk about concurrency. The thing that enables concurrency is this thing called data item versions. Basically, everything that you put in the cache gets assigned an ID, a unique ID, a tag, right, by the cache service. And you can use this for multiple things. You can use this to save bandwidth by only fetching things that have changed. So there is this method called getIfNewer, and you give it the ID of, so I have this thing that I cached locally, and then I remember that. I remember the actual option. Then if I want to say, is this something newer? Then you can go to the cache and say, fetch me this thing if it's newer than the last version that I got. It can also be used for optimistic concurrency because there are version-dependent overloads for put and remove. So you only update or remove things if they didn't change on the server. So the first piece of guidance on this topic is to only fetch data when it's changed. Remember what you got and refetch it only if it's changed. Right? And then the thing is that this only applies to non-trivial objects. If you got things that are super small and you're fetching those, don't worry about it. Right? Because by the time that it takes to calculate and then you have to go to the server anyways and all this stuff, it's not going to be worth it. What is that threshold? The answer is it depends. It depends on your system. It depends on your network. It depends on the computers that you're running this on. It depends on how much memory you're using, depending on the size of the objects that you're putting in the memory. So measure and find that out for your system. In the topic of concurrency, we have two major categories of how you do concurrency: optimistic concurrency and pessimistic concurrency. Optimistic concurrency is managed through versions. And basically, the idea is that in most cases, it can be optimistic, we won't have collisions. Okay? But if there are collisions, then resolving them might not be as easy. Okay, so this only works for cases where you don't expect collisions and if resolving a collision is fairly benign. But when you are concerned about making a current update, then you want to go with pessimistic concurrency, where pessimistic concurrency is based on locks. Go and say, this object, mine. Nobody touches it until I release it. Okay? So get and lock, put and unlock, are used to handle that, and you get basically a lock handle that you get to pass. You get it with a get, and then you pass it into the put. Put is update. When you're using the locking API, you need to be very careful. Locking is not enforced. It's an opt-in model, which means that everybody's got to play nicely. And if you got in the cache, some people that are going willy-nilly and deleting it without locks, and the other one are being very careful to use the locks, then the ones that are going willy-nilly and deleting without locks are completely going to ruin it for the other part. So don't mix that. And my tip on that is to use naming conventions and regions. So use regions, and within each region, use naming conventions that help the developers know that they need the lock. I call it user repository use locks. Right? That's the name. So when you type that in, you go like, use locks. Oh, okay, I need to use the locking API. Okay? And then I separate the locking and non-locking data into different regions just to keep things very neat. Okay? When you lock an object, it doesn't expire. But it might expire while you have it locked. And so as soon as you unlock it, boom, it goes. So there's an API for that, that when you say put and unlock, you can also extend the expiration. Okay? So watch out for that. These were the basic concepts. Now let's do the advanced stuff. If you have data that is easy to recreate or easy to refetch, right? You can just keep it in the local memory cache. Okay, that's easy data. And if you got important data, we already talked about it, that yeah, you can put it in the in-memory cache, but you need to back that by some sort of persistent storage like SQL. Okay, so if you don't want to lose the session, and by no, usually it's okay to, in some cases it's okay to lose the session. Okay, the cost is not that high, right? Somebody goes, picks, one, like movie tickets. Sure. So I go and I pick the movie ticket, and then I put my credit card information. If I lost the session, well, I'll go in and I'll order it again, in most cases. Okay? If the session is something very complex, took me 30 minutes to configure this thing that is very complex that I want to buy and has all these options, all those things. I spent 30 minutes on it, and then my session disappears. That's going to be annoying. Okay? And so in that case, the cost of losing the session is very high, and that's why I call it important data. It's still a session, but I'm not going to just rely on it in the cache. Okay? But there are things that are in the middle. Okay, data that I prefer not to lose, data that I can get again, but it's really expensive to get that. Right, like something I need to go to the mainframe or make a call to a service that is charging me by the call or whatever that is, or it takes a long time to compute. What do I do then? What I do then is enable what's called
called high availability. Sometimes you'll hear people talk about it as HA, high availability. And high availability is based on the idea that I'll always save two copies of the data in the cache. Now remember, this is done by the service. The client is completely oblivious to that. Remember the unified view thing? Client doesn't know, shouldn't know. And then if you got a node that failed, then all the data that was on that node now only has one copy. And so, it'll be replicated to another node. Okay? In most cases, you won't get like catastrophic failures where things, you know, it's like one server went down. Right? And so, that thing helps protect against that. If you got really catastrophic situation where something, you know, like a bunch of servers went down, a whole rack went away, that won't help. So make sure that you need high availability, okay? Because remember, your application, caching takes an application from good to great. So by default, it should withstand losing cache data, okay? And then high availability costs. There's replication going on all the time, so the network is busy, right? And then because you're keeping everything twice, you really have effectively only half the amount of memory. The other half is for the duplicates. So if you do have a high availability, have the need for high availability, set that up on a different cache cluster. Don't say, oh, I have these things of information that I need high availability here, so I'm going to enable high availability for everything. Okay? Just create different cache clusters. Any application can use multiple. The next concept is graceful shutdown. Graceful shutdown is another concept that has to do with what do I do with data that I have cached when something needs to go away. Right? So I need to patch a machine, I need to repair it, whatever else. I don't want to lose the data in the cache. So that's something that was added in version 1.1 of AppFabric caching. It exists in the cloud in the released version. And basically, it tells the cache, please move all your stuff somewhere else before you shut down. Okay. So again, it's used for planned upgrades, patches, all this stuff. And it's for both HA and non-HA scenarios. The next concept I want to talk about, I want to make a case for. If I need to maintain coherency between the cache and the data source, the system of record, meaning that I always have to have the cache show exactly what's in the system of record, I don't want to live with possibly stale data, okay? Then I need to do the following thing. I need to update the cache every time that the database updates. Right? That's the only way for me to make sure that they're always 100% in sync. How can we enforce that? Another thing that happens is that whenever I do a read, it might cost me up to 6 legs of traffic. Right? So I go to the cache. If it's there, great. That was 2. But if it wasn't there, I need to go get the data from the database and then go again to the cache and write that information, update that information. Right? So how can I make this thing more efficient? And the third thing is that when I access data, I'm using 2 different concepts to access data. I use a name value pair and I use something else for the data source. Right? So how can I unify that? How can I always treat the data in a uniform manner? The solution is with a technology called, or a methodology called read through and write behind. Read through works in this manner. So a user asks for data from the cache, right? If the data is in the cache, then that's fine. I'm just going to return it. If it's not in the cache, then there is a provider, okay, a plugin for the cache. And that plugin knows how to go and take the key. And using that key generates something that you can then go and query the underlying data source to get the answer. Just from a key to a query. Okay?
And then get the data, cache it locally, return it to the user. Right behind is the counterpart of that, the other side of this coin. When the user wants to write or update data in the cache, then the provider turns around and immediately stores that in the database. It's stored in memory, but immediately it goes and being stored in the database. So again, I have this conversion from a key to another update operation or insert operation on the database.
Routing a provider is not very hard. It only has two things that you need to implement, basically. Just these two conversions. But it's not always trivial, right? The trick there is really figuring out a good naming convention for the keys that helps you go and get the data right from the database or update it in the database as you need. So when do you use this? When you want to lower the round trips? When the client always needs non-stale data? Or when you're trying to save time or money, right? When you have remote data source access or complex queries or all those things that I talked about. And the way you do that is by saying the only way you get access to this data is going through the cache. And so all the users that are trying to get to this expensive resource, the only way they go through the resource is by going through the cache and the provider. You don't even expose that information in any other way. That's the only way to get to it, is through the cache. So, in most cases, read through right behind will be for what kind of data? No, resource, what kind of data category? We got what? Reference, resource, and activity. Thank you. So, is it going to be for reference, for resource, or for activity? Resource data.
Absolutely correct. You guys are becoming cache gurus.
Caching. We got the concepts. How do we make this happen?
Windows Server App Fabric caching. Windows Server App Fabric caching, cache runs on a cluster of servers.
It's called a cache cluster. Right? They're all part of this fabric. You use PowerShell to administer that.
And they all behave as a single entity. They communicate, they coordinate, and they store their information. You can store it, the configuration information. Can configure it to say either put it in SQL or use a XML on the file share. The recommended way to go about this is actually the file share, not the SQL.
And then usually you separate the cache cluster from the client or the web tier. Usually you can co-host them. You can have the cache with the same tier as or on the same server as the web browsers, as the web servers. But usually you want to separate them so that you can actually access the cache from multiple places without affecting the web tier. And usually the web tier might also be firewalled away from something, so one-way access. So if you want to if you want to make sure that all the access is available properly, and I want both the web tier but also a backend, a business logic tier, to be able to access the same data in the cache, then you make that a separate entity. A concrete example, one of those clients that I was talking to you about, those companies, they had a front-end server or set of servers and a back-end set of servers. So when you make the order and you interact with everything, you're on the front-end. But then when you actually go and buy, then you're actually redirected to a completely different set of servers that are more stringently managed and compliant and in the way that they store data because they deal with high sensitive data. So you get directed to a different, completely different array, but they need to share the shopping cart between them. Right? And so to share the shopping cart was actually stored in the cache array that was separate from the front end and separate from the back end so that the shopping cart could travel very nicely and easily, even though it was also stored in the database, but you don't have to go to the database to get it. And obviously, the more memory you put on the system, the better. But per node, the max recommended is 16 gigabyte per node. But you can have multiple nodes. You can have hundreds of gigabytes in your cache if you so wish to have. In Windows Azure, actually, go ahead, ask a question. How do you want, so the question is, how do you warm up the cache when you have all the XML file data? The XML file is just the configuration of the cache server. So when you bring a cache server, another node in the cache array, then that node information is stored in the XML configuration file. It's not about the content of the cache. Okay? And by the way, and then everything gets rebalanced, right? That node doesn't stay empty. Everything gets rebalanced when you add something in. So there's a little bit of resettling time after you add or remove something. If you do a graceful shutdown, right? There's some time that is that it takes for the system to rebalance itself. Windows Azure introduced a caching service. Caching as a service. Okay, like database as a service, like network as a service, like caching as a service. Right? It offered cache in discrete sizes from 128 megabytes to 4 gigabytes per named cache. And the idea there is that you didn't have to manage the cluster. All you go is you say, make an API call or go to the portal and say, I want this kind of cache, this size cache, and it gets provisioned. Okay? It offered a comparable API. But there are some differences there. It's no high availability. There are no notifications. So because there's no notifications for the high availability, when remember that thing when I go to the server and I ask it, hey, is this, you know, here are my keys. Did anything change? Because of that, you can only do time-based expiration or number object-based expiration when you have the local caching. There's no way to disable evictions. There's no regions. There's no tags. In fact, what you provision is the name, is a region. And so basically you connect to a named cache or a region rather than a cache cluster. Last Thursday, Microsoft unveiled the preview of Windows Azure Caching that is not a service, but rather an add-on feature to your existing instances. So it offers full client API parity with AppFabric caching, the server one. And then you have two options of how you go about it. The first one is you can add that to an existing cloud role. So I can take that and add that to my role. And the interesting thing is that, so it uses that role instance's memory. So it's sharing the memory of the role instance. And you have a slider where you can say, how much of the local memory do you want this cache service to use? The interesting bit about it is that, if you think about it, in a lot of cases, the cache grows with your application. If you got more users, and you need to have more web service, and you need to have a bigger cache. So it scales up and down with the number of nodes that you have. Smart. And guess what? You're already paying for the instance. You're paying for the virtual machine. So it doesn't cost anything extra. The second option there is to say, you know, this is all great, but I want a separate, dedicated cache. And for that thing, what you do is you say, I want to have a dedicated worker role, okay, that is going to be used, or a set of them, that are going to be used for my caching. And there you can just say, just use as much as you want, you know, much memory from that instance as you want, right? And that scales separately from the existing roles, and it costs like a compute node, which is less than what the cache as a service costs. So you need to choose the right caching model. And it's a very easy choice. In all cases, if you're using Azure, it'll be the new model. Because there are no predefined cache sizes. And you can build much larger than the 4 gigabyte. Because you are isolated, you're not sharing the cache service with any other users and not affected. And in no case were you affected, was there any leak of cache information across users. But here, but there was some, the cache array itself was affected by how many people were actively using it. Right? So a lot of people are using, and it's just a shared resource. Latency, it's about 4 times as fast. Okay, and guess what? There's no extra cost on top of the compute. So if you look at this thing side by side, this is the whole kind of big table comparison of this.
then pay by memory, because you're paying more memory for memory, in no case is it cheaper than doing the in-roll or dedicated. So let's rule that out. Now, if you look at the bottom, all those things are identical. So as we come to compare and say, which one should I use, we don't need to really think about that. So the thing that you want to think about, the things you want to think about is, do I want the scalability with the app or the tier, or do I want separate scalability? Right? Am I willing, am I okay paying for more, paying for other extra VMs that I'm going to spin out? And last but not least, competition for local resources. And I'll talk about this right now, in a little bit. Some people ask me this question. So should I use caching to reduce cloud costs? And the answer is no. The accessing data in the cloud is not free, but it is ridiculously cheap. Okay? When you want to access storage, I'm not talking about the cost of actually storing the data. That is separate from the caching. But you're actually paying each time you access. There's a transaction cost. But it's a cent for every 10,000 times you're accessing the data. You know what? It's not a lot of money. Right? Now, if you're getting stuff shipped across data centers, then that's 12 cents a gig to ship across data centers. But typically speaking, generally speaking, that you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't rely on data that lives in other data centers just because of latencies and other performance reasons. Using the cache in the same geographical region is free. You're not doing cross data center traffic. And these are all the good things, but then remember, cache also costs. So overall, you will probably be increasing the cost of your service, okay? Unless you're using the on-instance cache. You might be, as you say, increasing the cost of the service by using caching. And obviously, it'll give you the thing that you pay for, right? So you're getting bang for your buck. But you don't use cache to save money. What do you use it for? Obviously, speed of access to data. Whether that's SQL Azure, whether that there could be up to 400 milliseconds to get to the data. So you want to be very efficient, very quick. Azure storage, and obviously remote storage. Remote storage is in things that are stored in other regions or on premises, and accessing other services. So that's one thing. The other thing that most people don't think about is that Azure resources have cap limits on them, and you want to avoid hitting those limits. Okay? So if you're using messages, blobs, and things like that, then you get up to 5,000 accesses of those per second per account. That sounds like a high bar, but how about queues? That only goes to 500 messages on a queue. Well, how about getting data from Azure Table Store? You can only get up to 500 entities per second per partition. So if you want to avoid hitting those limits, you put a cache on top of that so you don't need to go and get that data. You also need to understand the implication of the cloud caching. These are the kinds of servers that you can get, the virtual machines that you can get in Azure. The first one, the extra small, is not supported for caching, whether that's in instance or a separate instance. And the reason is that it's got so little memory, but more interestingly, it has only 5 megabits per second of allocated bandwidth. Okay, it's good for like a low traffic website or for some testing. But remember, the cache needs to talk with the other instances. Both the cache servers themselves coordinate, right, as well as the client from instance A will go and hit the cache on instance B, and now the cache traffic is competing for user traffic. When you got co-located cache deployment, it competes for the local memory, but that's okay, you can choose higher memory instances. It competes for the local CPU, that's really negligible. The cache is super CPU efficient. You will not see very much in that regards, but it does compete for the network. And a network is a capped resource. Two things, easy ways to get started with caching. First one is ASP.NET Session State Provider. Okay? It comes with a cache. If you're using a web farm, you want to use that. It's faster than SQL. You make a simple config change, and then you basically enable the session state to be cached across the cluster. It uses cache aside, not read through write behind. Okay, but that's activity, because that session is activity data, so that's fine. Okay, and again, if you're concerned about session data loss, think about enabling HA. You can also use it for page output caching. ASP.NET page output caching is about serving the same output if you got the same inputs. Because if I got the same input for a definition of same input, then you can just serve the same output. You don't need to go and recalculate the page. You don't need to even invoke, you know, all your code and everything behind that. And the way you do that is you add this section to the config file, the top one, and then for each page that you want to cache, you just put this ASP.NET output caching tag on top of the page. You say, I want this thing stored for 60 seconds, and here are the parameters that come to this page. This one says star, so just to consider all the parameters, and if they're all the same, then just return the cached version of the page. And you can control what parameters, so if you have several parameters that matter and several that don't, then you can control how that thing gets returned. Summary. Caching, very important for performance, very important for scalability, but you can't have separate caches. It needs to be combined, centralized. Windows Server App Fabric caching, it's already on your Windows Server box, or if you need to download that. And then you got free, scalable, distributed in-memory cache. Just works. Windows Azure caching, doesn't cost you any extra, give you all the benefits of doing that in the cloud. And then understanding the type of data in your cache is the most important thing for your implementation choice. You need to understand what data you're storing, reference, resource, or activity, and that will affect everything. Cache aside, read through, write behind, client-side caching, version, and all that stuff. Next steps for you guys, analyze, categorize your data, figure out what am I putting in the cache, what kind of data is that, and then implement the caching correctly, implement it efficiently. And if you want to just start with something really simple, just use a session provider for ASP.NET. Measure your usage, optimize your usage. Remember what I talked about with the large objects, small objects, number of objects, all those things? Go back to the slides and read that later. Figure out how you can optimize your cache usage. Then make things run really fast. That's it. I'm Shai Cohen. You're all cache gurus now. Exactly. Please, 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 please. I know everybody wants to run to the, whatever, change your clothes, throw your bags away. You don't need your tags for the party. Just get your wristbands. But please make sure to fill out the eval. These are extremely important for us. We read every comment you put in there. Okay? And I hope you enjoyed the session. I will stay here and answer questions. If you want to leave, feel free to leave. If you want to ask questions, I'll be up here, and afterwards, you can catch me whenever you want. Thank you very much again.